I know more about taxes than any human being that God ever created.
Oh, okay. Cool. We'll remember that, Donald Trump from 2016. I'm sure prosecutors will.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in Red Bluff and Redding, California, on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Glad to have you with us, and welcome to another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. So a month or two ago, when New York Attorney General Letitia James announced that her investigation into tax and bank fraud by Donald Trump and his company had become a criminal probe. It was a civil investigation, then it became a criminal investigation, and that she was joining the Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance's long-running probe into similar matters. Back then, we were joined by former Assistant U.S. Attorney Randall Eliason to help us understand the difference between criminal and civil prosecutions and what all of that movement in the various New York cases against Trump might actually mean. Well, with the, as you know, with last week's criminal indictments of both the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, well, we now have a much better picture of what it all means, if it's still an incomplete one, according to legal experts who suggest the multiple and very serious charges related to a sweeping and audacious 15-year tax fraud scheme, as New York prosecutors have described it, are just the beginning, and that more charges against other senior executives at the Trump Organization, including Donald Trump himself, may still lie ahead in the case. Well, that's good news. However, our friend Randall Eliason has a different view of all of that. He thinks that this may not be the beginning of the case, but rather the end. Really?
I am not happy to hear that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It would, in fact, be disappointing, though I don't know that he is right about that. He, Randall Eliason, will join us shortly to explain why he, at least, is reading the tea leaves of Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance's case somewhat differently than many other legal experts, and I will press him on that case as I do, and we will see how it goes. In the meantime, Desi Doyen, we're not really a legal show here.
Definitely not.
I mean, we're not an illegal show.
Neither one of us are lawyers.
Correct. But we sure do seem to be covering a lot of legal stuff lately with a lot of attorneys for some reason in Donald Trump's United States of legal complaints, which is kind of where we are now. But you know what? I guess if Congress is broken, everything these days has to happen through the court system, it seems. Oh, well. On that front, Trump himself filed a lawsuit today, which seems pretty woeful to me. but a nice distraction for his supporters from Trump's real legal woes. But, you know, again, I'm not an attorney, so what do I know? Former President Donald Trump has filed suit against three of the country's biggest tech companies, claiming that he and other conservatives, as AP generously calls them, have been wrongly censored. Trump announced the action against Facebook, Twitter, and Google's YouTube, along with the company's CEOs, at a press conference in New Jersey on Wednesday. He was joined by other plaintiffs in this class action suit. The suits were filed in federal court in Miami. We're demanding an end to the shadow banning, a stop to the silencing, and a stop to the blacklisting, banishing, and canceling that you know so well, said Trump. I'm trying to keep a straight face here.
I know.
Under Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, social media platforms are allowed to moderate their services by removing posts that, for instance, are obscene or violate the service's own standards, so long as they are acting in good faith. The law also generally exempts internet companies from liability for the material that users post on their sites. But Trump and some other right-wing politicians and activists and propaganda outlets like Fox News have long argued that Twitter, Facebook, and the other social media platforms have abused that protection and that they should lose their immunity. Trump, of course, you will recall, was suspended from Twitter and Facebook and YouTube after his followers stormed the Capitol building on January 6 in an attempted insurrection against the U.S. government, incited in no small part by Donald Trump himself on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. The company cited concerns that he would incite further violence, which seems a perfectly legitimate good faith decision to have made, even if it came years later than it should have against this guy. Nonetheless, Trump has continued to spread lies about the 2020 election, baselessly claiming that he won, even though the state and local election officials, including Republican ones and his own attorney general and numerous judges, including some that he appointed himself, have all said there is no evidence of the mass voter fraud that he has been alleging since he lost in November. The suits, argue that banning or suspending Trump and the other plaintiffs is a violation of the First Amendment, despite the fact that the companies in this case are private companies. The First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech applies to the government. They cannot block speech, at least in most cases. It's not an absolute guarantee. It does not bar private companies from doing so at all. I don't, you know, have to allow anyone in the world to come to bradblog.com and leave comments about anything they want, no matter how untrue or how undangerous they may be, for example, even though I make every effort to try and do so. But you know what? If someone shows up and they start advocating violence on my website, they will not be allowed to do that for very long. Even government agencies have the right to hold people accountable for speech that leads to imminent violence. Trump's suit against Facebook and CEO Mark Zuckerberg says that Facebook acted unconstitutionally when it removed Trump from the platform. Suits against Twitter and YouTube make similar claims. All three ask the court to award unspecified damages, declare Section 230 unconstitutional, and restore Trump's accounts, along with the other plaintiffs, who Trump, I guess, is trying to hide behind here. A handful of them have also had their posts or accounts removed. Legal experts, however, and business associations immediately criticized these claims, according to the Washington Post, predicting they had little chance of succeeding in court. The lawsuits will find favor, however, among Trump's most fervent supporters, who, as according to the Washington Post, I call those fervent supporters suckers, who also enjoy playing the victim here. And they have long argued that social media companies treat conservative voices unfairly. Well, so the suit alleges here that the companies violated Trump's First Amendment rights by suspending his accounts, and they argue that Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are no longer private companies.
Really?
Yes. They're not private companies.
How do they get that?
They are, in fact, they should be considered a state actor whose actions are then constrained by First Amendment restrictions on government limitations on free speech. Paul Barrett, however, the deputy director of the NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights, said the lawsuits were dead on arrival. Trump has the First Amendment argument exactly wrong, said Barrett. In fact, Facebook and Twitter themselves have a First Amendment free speech right to determine what speech their platforms project and amplify, and that right includes excluding speakers who incite violence, as Trump did in connection with the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Indeed, the companies are expressing their First Amendment right to not put out these messages that we should all go and take down the U.S. government.
Yeah, like effectively the Trump lawsuit is arguing that those social media companies mm-hmm. should be forced. That would be forced speech
yes,
for them.
Yes, yes. The Florida law, just last week, a federal judge used similar reasoning to block a Florida law that tried to penalize tech companies who suspended politicians in the run-up to elections. That law, according to the district judge in Florida, would likely be found unconstitutional because it compels providers to host speech.
Yes.
That violates their standards, just as you say. Legal experts said Trump's claim that the companies should be considered state actors is also unlikely to succeed. Brian Fitzpatrick, professor of law at Vanderbilt University, said the fact that they benefit from a federal law does not transform them into the federal government. He said all of us benefit from laws at some point or another, and that doesn't transform us into the federal government. John Bergmeier, legal director at Public Knowledge, a nonprofit that promotes internet access, called the argument crackpot theory that people try to make from time to time in an effort to make the First Amendment apply to private corporations, which it does not. If that were true, he said, every corporation would be a government actor. Every company is chartered, after all, by the government. Does that mean that every corporation is therefore a state actor? Trump's lawsuits are likely doomed to fail, said Eric Goldman, a law professor at Santa Clara University in California. He studied more than 60 similar failed lawsuits over the past few decades, seeking to take on internet companies for terminating or suspending user accounts. Goldman said they've argued everything under the sun, including First Amendment, and they get nowhere. Maybe he's got a trick up his sleeve that will give him a leg up on the dozens of lawsuits before him. But I doubt it, said Goldman. He said Trump is likely doing this to garner attention.
And some money, too, by the way.
Yeah, if he's lucky, but I don't think he's ever going to see that that money. And I swear, every one of these stories that I looked at have legal experts all saying this suit is ridiculous. It's going to be tossed out. It's a crackpot theory. It will go nowhere. And I really try. I mean, they have no... You know, there's no, on the other hand, such and such expert at this place says
there's
something
no alternate
else.
Opinion.
No, they can't. I even went over to Fox News to see if surely they had something to support this nonsense. Well, they had one story about Parler, the alternative right wing Twitter social media platform that applauds this lawsuit. Of course, they applaud the lawsuit because, you know, it's going after their competition, I guess. But even Fox News has nothing. Here's what they have. Shoshana Weissman of the Libertarian R Street Institute. They went to her figuring that, you know, she'd be in favor of this free speech or whatever. Weissman pushed back on Trump's comments as well. She said the idea that tech companies, quote, benefiting from a law prevents them from being private is asinine. This is Fox News. Government cannot wave a wand and say you're public now. The idea that this is a subsidy is also nowhere near the truth. And finally, she says, government pressuring companies or companies taking cues from government entities also does not magically turn them into government actors. Weissman said this is a full misunderstanding of how the law works. Nonetheless, Trump made clear that this was all retaliation for having banned his accounts. He said that there's no better evidence that big tech is out of control than they banned the sitting president of the United States. If they can do it to me, they can do it to anyone, he said. But yeah, they don't do it to anyone.
Well, they can if you did the same things that he did.
Correct. I mean, they didn't even do it to you, Mr. Former Disgraced President. They didn't do it to you for years as you were fomenting violence and using their platforms to spread lies and misinformation. It actually took an attack, finally, years into this thing, it took an attack on the U.S. Capitol for them to realize that they needed to finally do the right thing and get rid of you. The Computer and Communications Industry Association, which represents the companies, called the suit frivolous. They said digital services have a right to enforce their terms of service. Frivolous class action litigation will not change the fact that users, even U.S. presidents, have to abide by the rules they agreed to. Of course, the folks who I'm really feeling sorry for here, are the lawyers who agreed to represent Trump in this nonsense. The damages that he's seeking are so far unspecified. Hopefully, these attorneys are planning to only get paid if they win and are awarded damages, because God knows Trump just ain't going to pay them for doing their job of lawyering if he loses the suit. Again, not a lawyer, but this suit seems to have no chance of success. Case in point, when it comes to not paying lawyers, Rudy Giuliani, who put his entire career and whatever was left of his reputation on the line for Donald Trump, flying all over the country from state to state, courtroom to courtroom, expending countless gallons of Grecian formula hair dye to spread his obviously disprovable lies about a stolen election, to the point where he has now had his law license suspended in New York and has had his apartment raided by federal prosecutors and is being sued for more than $1 billion by voting machine companies. And his thanks for all of that from Donald Trump? Well, former President Trump has reportedly cut ties with his former personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and has been annoyed with Giuliani's request for financial compensation in his efforts to overturn election results. An excerpt of Landslide, The Final Days of the Trump Presidency by Michael Wolff, published in the Times of London on Monday, documents Trump's frustration over his fruitless attempts to challenge his loss to Joe Biden after the 2020 presidential election. The excerpt adds to Giuliani's reportedly unsuccessful attempts at getting paid for legal work amid Trump's refusal to concede. Wolf wrote, according to the Times, Trump is annoyed that Giuliani tried to get paid for his election challenge work. Giuliani reportedly has, quote, gotten only the cold shoulder when asking Trump for payment and has been, quote, cast out, cut off by Trump's family. So sad. So sad. Wolf also reports that Trump has asked visitors of his Mar-a-Lago resort whether they, quote, know any good lawyers.
Oh, my.
To help in his efforts to overturn the election. As noted, the Justice Department is investigating whether Giuliani violated foreign lobbying laws while working as Trump's lawyer. Last month, he had his license to practice law in New York suspended as a result of his crusade to subvert the 2020 election. In its order, a New York appellate court stated, quote, there is uncontroverted evidence that Giuliani communicated demonstrably false and misleading statements to courts, lawmakers, and the public at large in his capacity as Trump's lawyer. And for that, no money for you, Rudy. Sorry, buddy. Giuliani is also seeking to get the defamation lawsuit filed against him by Dominion Voting Systems dismissed, alongside Trump campaign lawyer Sidney Powell and MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. Yes, anyone who touches Trump finds themselves in legal trouble. You would think that folks might have noticed that by now. It's not the law being unfair to you. It's Donald Trump. He's screwing you over. You people going to figure this out yet? Giuliani repeatedly pushed unfounded conspiracies about Dominion, flipping millions of votes away from Trump. And last week, Dominion pulled Giuliani into its lawsuit against Fox News as well. According to Bloomberg, Giuliani was issued a subpoena, yet another one, as part of the voting machine company's defamation suit against the news network, requesting all documents related to his appearance on Fox News dating back to 2016.
Wow.
The subpoena also seeks any communications that Giuliani had with the network about the 2020 election and Dominion. So, you know, yeah, I bet Rudy could use some money right around now for some more lawyers right around now, but he ain't going to get it from Donald Trump. Nonetheless, somehow, attorneys are still willing to keep representing Donald Trump. And he better be paying the ones who are now representing his company now that dozens of criminal indictments have been handed down to them and to the Trump Organization's chief financial officer for some 15 years of alleged tax fraud carried out by the company and its senior executives, more than one of whom is named Trump and may, I repeat, may soon be facing criminal charges in that same case, even if my guest coming up next, former Assistant U.S. Attorney Randall Eliason, is, shall we say, dubious about that. That conversation is next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Judas Priest.
Yes.
He sure has broken the law. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As you've likely heard by now, while we were off last week, both the Trump Organization and its longtime, decades-long chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, were indicted on multiple criminal charges filed by the Office of Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance. The charges include, among other things, scheme to defraud, conspiracy, grand larceny, criminal tax fraud, and falsifying of business records, none of which sound good. Trump's company was slapped with 10 charges, Weisselberg himself with 15, the most serious of which, grand larceny, carries 5 to 15 years in prison for the 73-year-old bookkeeper who began working for the Trump Organization when Donald Trump's father, Fred, ran the company back in 1973. Weisselberg is said by those who know the company to know where all the bodies are buried after nearly five decades there. New York prosecutors describe the indictments as accountability for a, quote, sweeping and audacious tax fraud scheme in which Weisselberg collected more than $1.7 million in off-the-books compensation, including apartment rent, car payments, and school tuition for his grandkids, on which prosecutors say taxes were never paid. Trump himself, other than describing the indictments predictably as a, quote, political witch hunt by the radical left Democrats, as he describes pretty much everything these days, hasn't said a whole lot about the charges, though he did refer to them during his rally in Sarasota, Florida over this past weekend, when also, as usual, he played the victim.
And yet they go after good, hardworking people for not paying taxes on a company car. Company car. You didn't pay tax on the car or a company apartment. You used an apartment because you need an apartment because you have to travel too far where your house is. You didn't pay tax. Or education for your grandchildren. I don't even know. Do you have to? But does anybody know the answer to that stuff?
Yeah, well, a lot of people know the answer to that stuff, including one would think Donald Trump. Donald Trump himself, at least Donald Trump from May of 2016, when he said at another rally that year,
I know more about tax abatements. I know more about taxes than any human being that God ever created.
Huh. But 2021, Donald Trump?
I don't even know. Do you have to? But does anybody know the answer to that stuff?
Well, I think my guest joining us momentarily may know the answer to that stuff. This is the first criminal case to come out of New York authorities' two-year investigation into the former president's business dealings, this one focusing on the company and Weisselberg himself, having allegedly cheated tax authorities by conspiring to pay senior executives off the books to avoid taxes on the compensation with lucrative fringe benefits and by other means. Weisselberg alone was accused of defrauding federal, state, and city governments out of more than $900,000 in unpaid taxes and undeserved tax refunds. Weisselberg's lawyers said he will fight these charges, and he pleaded not guilty after being marched, handcuffed, into the courtroom last week. Meanwhile, the former president was not charged with any wrongdoing yet, though prosecutors noted he signed some of the checks that are at the center of the case himself. They've described the 15-year scheme, which began in 2005 and ran through this year, according to the indictment, as, quote, orchestrated by the most senior executives at the Trump Organization. Trump, of course, being one of those most senior executives. In the wake of the indictments, many legal experts have argued that this is likely the first set of indictments, with more to come in the days ahead, perhaps even against the former president himself, especially if prosecutors are able to flip Weisselberg to testify against Donald. But one of our favorite guests, Randall Eliason, a longtime expert in white-collar criminal law at D.C.'s George Washington University Law School, as well as a former assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, where he served as chief of the Public Corruption and Government Fraud Section, tweeted otherwise, both before and after last week's charges were announced, to suggest that if the company was charged, that was likely a signal that, in fact, there would not be more charges to come. Well, that would be disappointing. Here to disappoint us is our friend Randall D. Eliason, who is a regular contributor to The Washington Post and, of course, his own Sidebars blog. Welcome back to the broadcast, Mr. Eliason.
Thank you. Great to be back.
So before you disappoint us, let's talk about the current charges themselves and how serious they are. To be clear, you're an expert in federal criminal law, not necessarily New York state law. But that said, you heard Trump there downplaying the use of company cars and free apartments and tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars in tuition for Weisselberg's grandkids. Are these, in fact, no big deal, small potatoes charges? Nobody even understands them. You know, as at least as you see them, as a former federal prosecutor focused on white-collar crimes.
Yeah, no, not at all. So the attorneys for Weisselberg and the Trump Organization have sort of tried to downplay these as just a fringe benefits case. You know, it's just about fringe benefits, and to make it sound as though it's about sort of the company maybe just failing to report something, you know, providing a fringe benefit like a company car and mistakenly not including it on their taxes, you know, something relatively minor that would never result in criminal charges. This really is a tax fraud scheme, as you described it, and, you know, what makes it so much more than just a failure to report some fringe benefits is this repeated reference to the fact that they basically keep in two sets of books. You know, they had internal records that show how we're really compensating Weisselberg so that we're not getting, you know, over the maximum amount that they actually wanted to compensate him for. And then they have the official records, like the W-2s and things, that are showing a much smaller amount so that he can avoid paying taxes on all that. So this whole, you know, for years and years, keeping two sets of books and repeatedly not failing to pay taxes on something, but, you know, falsifying all these official reports and documents and W-2s and tax returns about what his actual income is, that makes it a far more serious case than something that would be merely a fringe benefits case, as they'd characterize it. So, yeah, tax fraud for $1 million, I mean, that's a pretty serious case.
It seems like it, yeah. And I think you're noting here that this wasn't a mistake, that there's evidence that they went out of their way to carry off this scheme. For example, Weisselberg apparently kept a modest home on Long Island, according to prosecutors, where he claimed residency, but they say that he actually lived in a company-paid Manhattan apartment, concealing that he was actually a New York City resident, where he then failed to pay taxes, which are pretty high in New York City, along with hundreds of thousands in state and federal taxes, and even collected about $133,000 in refunds to which he was not entitled. So that seems, on its face, I'm not an expert here in this, you are, but that seems like a tough case to beat, since he seems to purposely be hiding all of that stuff.
Yeah, very deliberate. That's right. That, going back to the whole two sets of books thing,
yeah.
I mean, that makes it pretty hard to claim that it was just a mistake or a misunderstanding about the complicated tax code, you know, when you're actually keeping different records for your internal purposes and for what you're actually reporting to the authorities, and your own internal records show that you're actually compensating him, you know, to a far greater extent than what you're actually reporting. So, pretty tough case to defend.
The two sets of books, the private one counted Weisselberg's apartments and cars as part of his $940,000 a year compensation, and the other one didn't. And so a sort of two-part question here. Another prosecutor said, I don't see how you don't charge this. So I would want your opinion. Is he right? Is this something that you sort of have to charge? And the second part, where did that second ledger come from? Does this suggest someone within the company is cooperating with prosecutors that, you know, because that wouldn't have come from any of these subpoenas to banks for Trump's tax records and so forth that took so long to get?
Yeah, that second question is very interesting. I'm not sure that we know. I mean, certainly records were subpoenaed from the Trump organization as well, but, you know, did it get turned over in response to a subpoena on purpose or inadvertently, or like you said, is there some kind of informant on the inside? It wouldn't be surprising if they've got some kind of cooperator or somebody that they've immunized, you know, on the inside. There is this unnamed co-conspirator number one, you know, that sounds like maybe it was someone in the comptroller's office or someone in the payroll office, you know, perhaps maybe they've been immunized or maybe they're cooperating and that's why they're not unindicted, you know. I don't think we know yet.
I think the company's controller who was called to testify before the grand jury. Is it a normal practice? And again, I don't know if it differs on the federal level versus New York, but might that have been a case where he says, look, I will, you know, if you subpoena me, I will come in and testify to the grand jury. I'll give you documents, but you have to indemnify me in some fashion and not tell anyone that I'm giving you these documents, that sort of thing. Is that something that might have been done here?
Probably not the documents part. I mean, they could have certainly been granted immunity from, you know, his own prosecution.
Do they keep those deals secret? Might he been able to strike a secret deal so he doesn't get, you know, fired or in trouble or anything else? After all, he's sort of potentially singing on the you know, a guy who was the most powerful man in the world at the time.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's a grand jury investigation, so the whole thing is supposed to be secret. So, you know, it's certainly possible to have an immunity deal and have it not be public, you know, at least not yet.
The indictment details that Trump's company also issued checks at Weisselberg's request to pay for personal expenses, upgrades to his home, an apartment used by one of his sons, new beds, flat screen TVs, carpeting, furniture. Isn't that the kind of stuff that the 1980s hotel baroness Leona Helmsley, the queen of mean, was sentenced to prison for several decades ago and saw her entire hotel empire collapse in the bargain for?
Isn't she the one that said only the little people pay taxes?
Yes, that's her.
I seem to remember that case. It does sound, I think other people have drawn that comparison too. And didn't Trump make some kind of comment about Leona Helmsley at the time? I remember seeing some story about that, but...
I don't remember. Yeah, he probably either loved her or hated her as a competitor at the time. I'm not sure. But it does look like setting Weisselberg aside, it looks like going after the company here could be very harmful to the company. No, the company itself.
terms of, it, you know, brand and image and things like that, and some pretty hefty fines. Now, the thing about, you know, Jardine Corporations, of course, is you can't put the company in jail, so all you can do is hit them with some big fines, mm-hmm. and the business, you know, the brand, mm-hmm. you know, presumably takes a hit, although there's been a lot of that in the last 4 years.
Yes.
So, you know, are there still people out there who were perfectly okay with Trump and the Trump Organization before, but now will not be, you know?
Right. Oh, well, if he's going to commit tax fraud, I don't want to have anything to do with him. NBC also notes in their reporting, referencing the Trump Organization, I believe, that that they did nothing to address the tax shortfalls, even when they knew they were being investigated over this for the past couple of years. Why is that important here? Does it mean that they flaunted the law, or does it mean, or actually, does it support the premise that, hey, they didn't believe any of this was illegal, so of course they kept doing it?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I haven't seen that reporting, but you can argue both ways, as you just suggested. I mean, if you're the company, you might look at that and say, look, if I go back now and pay all these back taxes, I'm basically it's an admission, right? I'm agreeing that they're correct, that they should have been paid, and so maybe you stand fast and say, we're going to fight this and take the position that all of this was mm-hmm. appropriate somehow, and we're not going to concede that something was wrong by going now and paying back taxes later on.
So should this have been, or could this still be, actually, a federal case? We're talking, you know, presumably hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal taxes that were also not paid through this scheme. That would seem to be a federal crime. Could this still become one, or is there any reason why it has not been one so far?
Yeah, certainly potentially. I mean, as you said, the largest dollar amount in the indictment of taxes that are avoided are to the federal government. So you've got New York prosecutors basically alleging, you know, fraud against the federal government as the victim.
Yeah.
You know, which is fine, but like you said, that raises the question of why isn't it a federal case? And I don't know. I don't think we know if the U.S. attorney in New York, you know, considered that or is potentially still considering it. Mm-hmm. I think there might be statute of limitations issues for federal charges, at least with some of these allegations. But yeah, there's no reason in principle that it couldn't be a federal tax case as well. What we don't know is whether that's been considered and discarded, or mm-hmm. is still being considered, or if there's, you know, some other reason that there were no federal charges.
Well, and they did say that the scheme was ongoing up until this year, so it doesn't seem like the statute of limitations would have told yet in that case. And do we see that sometimes from federal prosecutors, whether there will be a state case, state prosecutors will bring a case, it will reveal information that involves the feds, and the feds therefore get into the case later, either with their own charges or join the state in some fashion?
You know, I can't think of another example. There's certainly nothing mm-hmm. that prominent. I mean, you can certainly see where that would happen, and the flip side happens maybe even more often. You know, the feds start investigating something because usually they got more resources, and it reveals something that then the state prosecutors come in and pick up on state charges. But, mm-hmm. yeah, that's definitely possible again, but it does seem like, you know, there would have been plenty of information available to federal prosecutors about these types of schemes.
Except for the fact that Donald Trump was running the federal government at the time, that they have been investigating these things.
Right. No, exactly. Yep.
Go ahead.
And didn't disclose his tax returns until Vance got them, you know, until the New York DA finally got the tax returns disclosed.
Right, right. Yeah. Is it a valid legal defense? You heard at that Sarasota rally there where he was sort of, you know, pretending, is this even illegal? I don't know. Do you have to pay taxes for the grandkids? Is that a valid defense strategy that he just had no idea, especially since we have, I also played that other clip from, I think, 2016, you know, where he's saying, I know more about taxes than anyone on God's green earth. And he had said that several times. Now, of course, he might have been boasting, I know, as unlikely as that seems from Donald Trump. But does that sort of thing get used against him if and when he makes the claim that he had no idea that this was a valid strategy?
Yeah, and I've seen, you know, others suggest that that was very deliberate, the statement at the rally, you know, to try to backtrack on some of those earlier claims to be this great tax expert.
Right.
Because certainly if they got to the point where they were considering charges against him personally, you would expect that to be a defense, which is basically, who understands this stuff? I rely on my lawyers and my accountants. You know, Alan said it was fine to do it this way. They're the experts, and you can't expect me, the big picture CEO guy, to really understand all the ins and outs of this stuff. And I would expect to see that kind of defense from him again, if he were ever to be charged personally.
And but it would be a valid defense if he could make that argument. But it does seem like his comments from earlier, which I guess he'd have to say, "Oh, I was just boasting at the time. Actually, I know nothing about taxes." I guess that's the way you'd have to go about it. All right, now
it's a combination of sort of lack of knowledge and advice of counsel. You know, a kind of reliance on the experts. You know, I've got tax lawyers that do this for me. I've got accountants like Weisberg that do this for me, and I depend on them and rely on their expertise. And so I had no criminal intent myself.
So that brings us to the point where you get to disappoint everybody, Randall Eliason.
Oh, no.
You posted both before and after the charges were filed that if the company was charged in this first round of indictments, that would be a signal, as you saw it, that there may not be more charges to come against individuals later, such as Trump, for example. Please explain, Randall Eliason.
Okay, well, I hate to disappoint. And of course, we should preface this by saying everybody who's making these claims about either there's a lot more to come, or, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg, or saying this looks like all there's going to be, we're all just speculating, right? Mm-hmm. We're all just trying to read tea leaves. So, because we're not involved in the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I look at an indictment like this, the reason I have that reaction is I don't know why you charge the company now if there's more to come. Because typically, in a case like this, indicting Weisselberg makes sense, right? That first tweet you referred to was before we knew you know, whether he was going to be included, it was going to be just against the company.
Mm-hmm.
So indicting him makes sense if you're still trying to pressure him to cooperate. But typically what you would do, if that's your strategy, is to, you know, indict him alone. You try to isolate him, single him out. You're out here all by yourself, Alan. You know, no one else is going to help you. You're not going to have this team of Trump Organization defense lawyers working with your lawyer to fight this thing off. We're isolating you, cutting you off, charging you, and you better flip and cooperate and save yourself. You know, they didn't do that. They indicted him with the company. That suggests to me that maybe they think this is all they're going to get. They've tried to get Weisselberg to cooperate, reportedly, you know, for a long time. He's refused. He's been loyal to Trump for decades. You know, if he hasn't cooperated by now, you know, you can indict him and it ups the pressure, but, you know, unless they're now able to convince him to cooperate, it's hard to see that there's likely a whole lot more to come. If they had cases against these other executives that they mentioned in the indictment, why not charge them now, right, at the same time? So it looks like failing cooperation by Weisselberg, that the fact that they included the company makes me think, if he doesn't flip, that's all we're going to have, because otherwise you hold off on the company, you isolate Weisselberg. And if you bring cases against other individuals, with or without Weisselberg, that just makes the case against the company stronger, because the company is only liable, you know, vicariously through the acts of its agents. So if you got three or four of them indicted, then the case against the organization is that much stronger. So you don't charge the company now if you think there's more to come. That's the basis of my tea leaf reading.
Yeah, and let me push back against that a little bit. And, you know, maybe because I want to see Donald Trump and Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric and all of them go to jail. But the first tweet, this was before the charges came out, you said, if you had cases against individuals, you would lead with those. Indicted individuals can be persuaded to flip and cooperate against those higher up the ladder, a classic investigative technique. But the company, an artificial official entity can't flip on anyone. If you lead with indicting the company, that's probably all you got. Now, according to years of reporting, Randall, Trump's company is pretty much everything to him. Can't a case be made here that in going after the company, that they are, essentially trying to scare Trump himself? They're simply, you know, increasing the pressure on the entire situation. They're looking at a case where Trump's company could, you know, owe hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe millions, maybe broken up even. I don't know if that's a possibility in something like this. But wouldn't that be a plausible reason to go after the company early on here and to send the message that, yeah, we mean business in these charges?
And so as a result of that, Trump comes in and pleads guilty to something. I mean, in other words, you can pressure mm-hmm. Trump and you can hurt him by hurting his company, but not in a criminal prosecution sense, usually. He's not mm-hmm. going to respond to that by saying, okay, you got me, now I'll plead guilty. Hmm. So that's the difference, I think.
Well, maybe he might say, okay, let's make a deal. You know, I see that you got me here. How can we settle this amicably? And you know, so nobody has to go to jail. We'll pay the fines. We'll do what needs to be done. That's my thinking.
That sounds to me like the language of civil litigation, right? But not a criminal prosecution.
Gotcha.
I mean, you don't pressure someone to come in and plead guilty by indicting their company, because that's just about money.
Okay.
You know, you might bankrupt him or something, but that's not necessarily going to come in. He's not going to come in and say, okay, I'll plead guilty to tax fraud if you let my company go.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not going to happen, right?
Right. Okay, well, I'm not going to let you disappoint me and all the listeners that easily, Randall. Your second tweet on July 3rd, now this would be after the July 1 indictment, I think. You tweeted, many are confidently asserting there is more to come with the New York indictments. I'm less confident. It likely depends on whether Weisselberg will flip. And if he hasn't by now, there's little reason to expect that will change. He could have gotten his best deal pre-indictment. Well, A, that presumes that he's a good deal maker. But otherwise, is that true that, that if he hasn't flipped already, he's unlikely to do so? For example, in the case against Congressman Matt Gaetz's buddy down in Florida, Joel Greenberg, there prosecutors charged him and have kept adding more and more additional charges until eventually it appears that he decided to cooperate. Why wouldn't there be a similar pressure campaign against Weisselberg here? Bring the charges now, 15 serious charges, as you describe them, and increase the pressure. Bring more charges. Let him know that he's looking at a 73-year-old man. He's looking at, 5, 15, 20 years or longer in jail.
Yep.
Wouldn't that work to help flip him?
No, I think I mentioned earlier, indicting him does increase the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. And maybe that'll happen. But I'm just looking at, the months of apparently trying to get him to cooperate unsuccessfully when mm-hmm. he could have gotten the best deal for himself. I mean, and, he's got lawyers telling him about the seriousness of these charges, and if they indict them, it's going to be hard to defend, mm-hmm. and so just sort of, again, if he was in a cooperation mindset, he's much better off if he does a pre-indictment. Now, if he was just too stubborn to do that and has a change of heart now that he's been indicted, absolutely.
Mm.
That's possible. But again, just looking at the fact that they indicted the company with him again mm. instead of trying to isolate him, and that's really how you maximize the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have the company's lawyers with you here,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Weisselberg. You're really off on your own. You cut him out and isolate him. The fact that they indicted him with the company, again, speculating.
Yeah.
It just feels to me like, sure, if he decides not to cooperate, there could be more potential charges, but they're sort of expecting that this is going to be it, absent that.
And of course, when you describe him as, perhaps he was too stubborn to go along to cooperate, I think he might have been too scared. At that point, we've heard Donald Trump speak in years past about, how much he hates so-called rats. The people shouldn't be allowed to flip, and it might be harder to flip before you're charged with indictments versus afterwards, when you can say, look, I'm looking at, 20 years in jail if I don't flip at this point. But again, maybe I'm just, you know, wishful thinking. Last question for you, Randall. Andrew Weissman, he was part of the special counsel Robert Mueller's team. His response to this question was also tweeted: with all due respect to those who think the DA charges this week were all there is, I disagree. This was a shot across the bow. More to come. DA message to Trump Organization employees: cooperate now or face charges and jail. That's how this works, says Weissman. Your response to to his thought there?
Yeah, well, he's not alone. Like you said, there are plenty of other people reading the tea leaves the other way. I think I've explained why I see it the way it looks to me, that I'd be much more inclined to agree with that point of view had they not indicted the company yet.
Gotcha.
If they just cut Weisselberg out and singled him out to really try to maximize the pressure. But, you know, like I said, we're all speculating.
Yeah, got it.
Trying to read tea leaves.
Yeah.
People shouldn't be too disappointed. I'm just, you know...
Oh no! You've
telling you what? Telling you how things look to me from the outside, but we don't really know.
Too late, Randall. You've ruined everyone's day. Nice job, but the good
time I'm invited on the show.
No. Because if in fact Trump is indicted, we'll be having you back so that I can rub it in your face. And
okay,
if he's not indicted, then you can come back and rub it in my face and tell me how you had it right all along.
Come back and say I told you so.
Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Hey,
fair enough.
Thank you, Randall. Randall D. Eliason, law professor at D.C.'s George Washington University Law School, former assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, contributor at Washington Post, and his own blog, sidebarsblog.com. You can also find him on the Twitters if you'd like to tell him that he is either wrong or right, at R.D. Eliason. Randall, always great speaking with you, my friend, and I hope we get to do it again soon, because that might mean that someone else has been prosecuted.
Look forward to it. Thanks. Thanks,
Randall. Okay, quick break, and we are back with maybe some goodish news.
Goodish
is the right way to put it.
Yes.
All right, that goodish news is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. In our closing few minutes here, as I said, I think this is some good-ish news, sort of. Tropical storm Elsa made landfall Wednesday on North Florida's Gulf Coast and could bring with it as much as 9 inches of rain, flooding, and life-threatening storm surge. I know that does not sound like good news.
Right.
But it could have been much worse. It made landfall in Taylor County with maximum sustained winds near 65 miles per hour and higher gusts. Tropical storm force winds extended outward up to 90 miles. But even with all of that, Florida, at least, may have dodged a bullet here, Desi Doyen?
Yes. And again, not to downplay the impacts, the very real impacts on all of the communities that are within Elsa's range of impact here. But yes, the fact that Tampa Bay, once again, has not been suffering a direct hit by a hurricane is good news. Because as we described in our previous episode, that Tampa Bay is situated in such a way that a direct hit from a major hurricane would be catastrophic. And the storm surge alone would be extensively damaging, let's just say that.
And this one was looking like it was heading right that way.
It certainly did, and I was very concerned that it might, but it didn't. It skirted up the coast of Florida, and it missed. And so Tampa Bay indeed dodged a bullet. In fact, AccuWeather said that Tampa Bay seems to have this mystical ability to avoid a direct hurricane strike. So, you know, knock on wood that it holds far.
Because this is, I think, one of the earliest tropical storms or hurricanes to come ashore in the Atlantic hurricane season. It's the earliest fifth named storm to form.
Yes, and the last time Tampa Bay was hit was 1921.
Really?
There's been a huge amount of construction and development in
since
the meantime.
Then. Nonetheless, it's still not good. 26,000 customers as of this morning were without power in three different counties. I'm sure those numbers have gone up. Meanwhile, in Surfside, on the opposite coast from where Elsa made landfall, crews are still working on the pile of the collapsed condo building for the 14th day. They were contending with winds and rain, but it was not bad enough that they did not have to pause work overnight on Tuesday, according to officials today. That said, the death toll has now ticked up over 40 in that disaster, with about 100 still accounted for.
Unaccounted for.
And as officials are moving now, they say, from a rescue operation to a recovery operation, meaning after 2 weeks of this disaster, they no longer expect to find anyone alive, unfortunately. As to Elsa, it will move now into Georgia on Wednesday night and the Carolinas on Thursday, and then head northeast from there, according to the Hurricane Center. So this is still going to cause a whole lot of rain, a whole lot of damage. So
A
lot of flooding. So if you're in the line of that storm, do be careful.
Yes, and just want to reiterate one thing. If you are in anywhere where there are torrential rains like this and flash flooding, do not drive across flooded roadways. I know that officials keep saying that. The reason they keep saying it is because even 6 inches of water is enough to knock down a fully grown adult and can also sweep away your car. So just don't do it. Turn around.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. My thanks as well today to Randall Eliason of George Washington University Law School, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, along with, 15, 17, 20 years or so of our broadcasts, of course.
Plenty to keep you busy.
Yeah. Or in tears, depending on how you look at it. As noted yesterday, all of this is free to you, but it is not free to produce and put out there. We could really use and appreciate your support at bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the Facebooks and the Twitters, you'll find me, not banned yet, at The Brad Blog. I will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.